Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. The calm before the storm is what I'll call this panel this morning. But we'll probably get a little stormy ourselves. Sure, that's what we do here on the roundtable panel. We love talking to you about what's happening in the world, and we welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm okay. As you probably know, Joe, I do my usual 4 miles outside, but it was so cold this morning, I knew I couldn't make it. So I made a path within the house itself, going back and forth and back and forth.
We call that pacing.
Back and forth. Not pacing. I was walking.
Okay.
But I didn't quite make what I needed to do, so I'll have to, after this is over, I'll have to walk to town. Now you've heard my whole story.
You know, if we can equip Alan with a headset, he could walk back and forth while doing the show.
I could do that. Yeah.
Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is here. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to the snowstorm, actually. I get excited for the first snow.
Yeah, we do too.
For the first. Yeah.
No, yeah. It is. It's fun.
I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I'm thrilled.
It's all good.
Yeah.
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness. Does that include snowstorms, Bob?
It could, but I mean, I'm just still thinking about Chris Churchill's fetish. It's really disturbing.
I'm sorry?
His fetish about snow.
Oh, I see. I gotcha.
I'm like, oh, God.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. And I'm still back on Ray's weather report because I completely understood it.
Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is the gentleman you just heard. And investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning, and I am with Bob on this wonder of snow, long disappeared when you live in upstate New York, and I am not looking forward to Chris's annual paean to the wonder and beauty of whiteness. Ugh.
Yeah, well,
well, that's only
I won't write it this year, Rosemary.
That only goes until the dogs get out there. Then the white disappears.
True.
It's painting a picture. I like it. Okay.
Yes.
Good morning and welcome. Let's go and start the day here. We begin with the story which we touched on yesterday, but now we know a little bit more about it, which is Mitch McConnell deciding that, maybe Joe Biden really did win the election. So... These things are, we take our victories where we can get them. So Mitch McConnell yesterday made his sharpest and most significant break from President Trump on Tuesday, which from the looks of my calendar, Bob, you can help me out on this, but I believe is 6 weeks from Election Day. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Just wanted to double check on that. 6 weeks from Election Day, made his sharpest and most significant break from the president, firmly acknowledging that Joe Biden as the rightful president-elect, even as Trump refused to publicly admit his decisive loss in both the Electoral College and the popular vote. In a Senate floor speech early on Tuesday, McConnell rattled off accomplishments he attributed to Trump and his administration, but made it clear that he accepted the Electoral College's certification Monday of Biden's victory, something he and the majority of GOP lawmakers in both chambers had declined to do for weeks. And then he did the weird thing, which is that privately he went on the phone, talked to top deputies and said, look, urging Senate Republicans not to join the long shot effort led by conservatives in the House to challenge the Electoral College results when Congress formally tabulates the vote on January 6th. His remarks were confirmed by three officials familiar with the call, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Even if House Republicans were able to draft a senator to challenge the vote, the chances of success would be slim to non-existent, given the states won by Biden have already certified their results. Such a push would effectively delay the inevitable, since the measure would certainly fail in the democratically controlled House. Alan.
Well, yeah, you know, Steve Allen. Remember Steve Allen,
Joe? I do, yeah. Married to Jane Meadows.
Well, he was very, very careful what he said. he had a word which was not a Yiddish word, which meant a bad thing. Well, it meant you could put it on the radio. So he would say smuck.
Yeah.
Smuck. Do you remember that?
I do.
Now, smuck is not the other word. It's close to it.
Yeah.
And that's what Mitch McConnell is. Smuck, smuck. I mean, honestly, you know, this president has done more to delegitimize democracy and elections than any other before him ever. And so so this is a little late to the table, as far as I'm concerned. He gave a rational explanation, his explanation being that what has really been created here is a terrible potential disaster for the Republican Party. Therefore, we shouldn't get involved in this last-minute nonsense. Well, one would think that it would be better if he said, don't do it because it isn't right. But he's not saying that, that's for sure.
Or if he had said it weeks ago.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Which is why I say smuck.
Okay. follow that, Bob Griffin.
There's a couple points here. One is it is too little too late. I really do feel like McConnell and the other Republican senators should have recognized the outcome of the election much sooner. I also think that this is a salvo of an internal fight within the GOP as far as what their future is going to be. I would imagine, you know, just watching McConnell for a number of years, is that he is playing to a couple of different audiences, including the election in Georgia. And so making sure that sort of the crazy wing nuts that are continuing to push these conspiracy theories don't help tank the Republican chances there. But longer term, Joe, I think he is trying to regain control of the overall GOP from Trump. So I think there's a lot of internal fights going on that are starting to be reflected in both his public comments, particularly in those back comments, the anonymous comments, which I actually put a lot of credit to, credence to.
Rosemary Armao.
Well, okay, I have said for some time that I can't understand what McConnell's game plan is. I know that he thinks long term and he has multi-pronged efforts, but why did he wait this long? He sold out to Trump, and he still hasn't helped the party or the country in the way he handled this. So I don't get what his thinking was. Does he think that now Trump is completely neutered and so it's safe to go after him? That certainly isn't courageous, but it also doesn't serve his purposes. He could have done this earlier, I think. I also don't understand how not approving a stimulus bill, although I don't believe the latest reports that we're getting closer are accurate. So he didn't approve a stimulus bill, and what is he doing to help the two elections in Georgia by playing this game with Trump? I have to confess, I do not see a game plan here.
Yeah. I do want to get back to, I want to hear from Chris, but I would like to talk a little bit more about the stimulus package too. Chris, go ahead.
Well, I see at least a little bit of a game plan. I mean, by urging senators not to go along with the objections that will be raised on January 6th, he's trying to protect his members from having to make a very difficult vote, right? Either to stand with Trump or to go against him.
Right.
I mean, that's a vote that could play a lot of different ways depending on which state you're from. You know, it could anger some Republicans, it could anger Democrats. I mean, so I know, I think he's looking toward protecting McConnell. I mean, is always playing a long game. And like I said before on this show, he knows when to be quiet. And he knows when to speak, and I think
he knows when you're sleeping
because, yeah,
knows when you're awake. Go ahead.
Yeah, he doesn't have the beard though.
No,
but maybe he'll grow that.
No, you need a chin for that. But go ahead.
Yeah. But so I know what he's doing, at least in terms of the call that he made yesterday to the senators, does make a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think it won't serve his members well at all if they're forced to vote on on whether or not to object to the results.
You know, I think Chris is onto something too. Is that one of the things that, that you get to tip your hat to McConnell? He does give his senators top cover. So by coming out as forcefully as he did, he's able to sort of be the focal point for anger and ire from Trump and from Trump supporters. And so, Chris, I really do think that that point is really important and shouldn't be dismissed. He freed up the senators to move forward with less of a fear of reprisal from Trump and others.
So I think Rosemary's onto something here, which is Georgia. There's a lot going on. The control of the Senate now lies in this Georgia election, and if those people are convinced that they have to vote for the Democrats because the Republicans are being irresponsible, I think he understands that, and that this is where his power lies right now.
Rosemary?
I am noting that all of us agree that there was nothing noble or revelatory in this pivot. It's not like you suddenly saw the light. It's all been calculated, and that certainly is the Mitch McConnell that I know and am familiar with. There's nothing good about this. I also don't understand Rand Paul, who is considering leading the effort, that you need someone from the House and someone from the Senate right. to make this complaint about the Electoral College. Why would Rand Paul do that? He just likes to be the odd person out, I think. It's very odd.
Yeah. And it's a desperate cry for attention.
Georgia. Yeah, cry for attention. I'm really sick. His father must have ignored him as a child or something. How this plays out in Georgia is interesting. There's apparently record numbers of people involved in early voting, and that's on both sides, the Republican and the Democratic side. So how is this playing out? How does your support of Trump's sore losership play out in who you're going to vote for in the Georgia race?
So Joe,
really is another referendum on Trump.
If you're what Trump is starting to do is that he's so undermining people's confidence in elections, they're saying, well, why should I bother? So right. His ardent supporters are saying, it's a total fix. I'm not going to vote. And actually, it's not that.
Let me interrupt because you need to address this. That has not happened. Apparently, there's record involvement on both sides. It's not that people are dropping out.
What's going on in the margins, right? I mean, it's early, so you don't know what's going to go on in the margins. And this could be one of those elections where 2 or 3 percentage points makes a huge difference.
I know we all collectively agreed we were never going to look at polls again, right? But the polls show
not
both,
me.
But polls do show both Democrats ahead at this point.
Yeah, I would doubt that.
Yeah. Don't believe it.
I did preface it with that. I'm just saying.
Yeah, where the polls went wrong is they underestimated Republican support by, 3 or 4 points, sometimes more. And I would suspect that's also the case in this election. Although, like as others have alluded to, the turnout and everything in this one is so fluid and so unpredictable because you just don't know how all these various things are going to factor in. I mean, after McConnell's statement yesterday, Trump was tweeting that Kemp is going to jail.
Yeah.
Right. The Republican governor of Georgia is going to go to jail. I mean, I don't know how that resonates or how that affects Republican voters in Georgia. It's just all very, very difficult to sort through.
Especially since Trump won the election in Georgia. Now he is saying these guys, not only the governor, but the elections guy, are going to jail.
Trump lost Georgia.
Trump lost
I know
Georgia.
That.
Did you say Trump won?
Thank you for the catch. No,
yeah,
that's
it was
right.
A little sarcasm.
But these people in Georgia voted Trump out in their minds. He lost in Georgia. So, and exactly my point, which is well said. And thanks for the save. And what it means is you are basically dissing the people who voted for Kemp. Excuse me, for that's stupid. Voted for the people who voted for Biden. So I would be angry if that happened to me.
What do you think? And I'm we only have about a minute, but it is interesting too. As Biden was in Georgia yesterday, and there's been one debate. I don't know. I don't think there's going to be another debate on the other side with John Ossoff and Perdue. But you do wonder where it goes from here, because you have the holidays and then you have the election on what, January 6th? Is that right?
I think that was 5th.
5th. You're right. January 6th is the other D-Day as far as the voting. You're right.
Listen, do you think Biden would have been there if he didn't think they had a shot?
Well, yes. That's sort of my question. Now, that was, is it?
Yes. He would be there because he listens to polls. He went to Ohio and Florida in the last days of the election.
But Rosemary, that's right. But if he's listening to polls, or if they're doing internal polling, which I assure you they're doing in the Biden camp, and he thinks they've got a shot, he shows up.
All right.
They certainly have a shot.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue to discuss this. We have the letters that I was looking for in vain I found. So we will read those in just a moment. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you all with us. Okay, so we were talking about polls and talking about what was going on in Georgia. So looking at, I'm going to read three numbers to you. First of all, the 538, what do they call that? Mashup of the polls, the average of the polls, shows both John Ossoff and Reverend Warnock in the lead, but by very slim margins as of December 15th, which was yesterday. 48.2% for Ossoff, 47.9% for David Perdue. Meanwhile, in the other race, Reverend Warnock at 48.4%, Loeffler with 47.4%. The other two numbers that I will give you, one is from the Survey USA poll. I give you that poll because it is one of the few that is rated an A by 538. They rate the polls. And so their number is Ossoff up by 2, 50-48, and Warnock actually up by almost 7. In that contest, 52-45. Meanwhile, that poll was taken a week ago. In the more recent poll, in the poll that was taken yesterday, it has it basically as very similar to the numbers. That poll from Insider Advantage, which rates a B- on 538, comes up with pretty much the same numbers as I read being the collective with Warnock at 48.4 and Ossoff leading with 48.2. So a very, very close election, no question about it. But there you go.
So, Joe, I think we should tell you that a school, a bunch of fish is called a school. It's a Congress of baboons. I think we should call it a mistake of polls.
Yes, a mistake of polls. I like that. Yes. That's good. I like that.
Because I have no faith in the polls.
No. I understand why.
These polls you can have faith in because they're so close. I mean, you know, if somebody can say, see, those polls were wrong again, what, 0.2%?
Yeah, but even in the polls, you're right, Alan, but even in the polls that we saw on Election Day that showed that, a race, I think in seeing some of the polls with Harrison, right, and saying that, it was going to be 0.8% difference, and it turned out to be, 9 points or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
But, I mean, in Georgia, at least, we had the best poll possible at the start of November, and that was the election, right? And Perdue only beat Ossoff by, a point and a half, something like that. So we know the race is going to be close.
Yes.
But where polls usually get it wrong is on turnout. They just, it's very difficult to predict who's going to show up. And it was more difficult this year with mail-in voting and with the coronavirus pandemic and all sorts of other factors. And I think that's certainly true of these Georgia runoffs. I mean, the races are certainly winnable for Democrats, but they're also very winnable for Republicans. It just depends on who gets out to vote.
And, you know, like Rosemary said,
is really high. So that's,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's also very interesting to read about the different factors going into this Georgia race, aside from the pandemic and the insanity of Trump calling elections and voting in general into question. There's the whole changing demographics in Georgia, which I have been unaware of, that there is a huge building boom, for example, in Atlanta that's brought in tons of people from outside. So it isn't just native Georgians anymore. It's a different demographic, and that plays into this. So basically, the polls can show what we already know. It's going to be close, but they cannot be a predictor. And we're crazy to look at them to tell us who will win. It's going to all come out only after the actual voting.
Yeah, Rosemary, I think you're on to something really important, is that there's a substantive shift going on in this country that, you know, I'd love to hear from some sociologists and some other researchers about what this means. But this is not insignificant. I mean, this is at the beginning of a major upheaval in what we thought we knew about where states stand politically and philosophically. And you're right, we don't know what the impact is. We also don't know what the impact is on the states that are losing populations that have been more traditionally liberal. A lot of play here, a lot of really interesting long-term impacts that we should be keeping an eye on.
I mean, go ahead, Rosemary.
Well, I said we saw this in Virginia, which has completely flipped in the last few years. And Florida continues to be on this balance between blue and red. And every wave of immigration, not that there were any waves of immigration during Trump, but that continues to change the pattern of voting in those states. And you're right, sociologists are the ones who may give us more insight into election results rather than pollsters.
Now, nobody has mentioned race yet, and that's an important factor here, because one of the reasons I believe post hoc, propter hoc, that we found out that Trump lost and Biden won in Georgia was that there was a huge African-American turnout. And the question is, will that continue in these races? And, you know, you have Reverend Warnock. I mean, here's a guy who is the senior preacher at the Martin Luther King's church. So, you know, I think I think it's not surprising to me that he is outdoing Ossoff in terms of his lead as a Democrat.
Yeah, but also I think there's the other piece there, Alan, is that I think Loeffler is a much weaker candidate too.
Yeah,
she certainly is.
If you really look at some of the comments and mistakes that she's made, although both of them have both Perdue and Loeffler have some significant ethics lapses that need to be explained. I think Perdue is a smoother candidate.
Which is why he didn't want to debate.
Yes.
Well, the last debate where Ossoff just called him a crook to his face was really
not
great.
Not to his face. He wasn't there.
Oh, no. At the first debate where they were together.
Oh, first, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why he never debated him again. Yeah, he never debated him again after that. All right, Gordon says, who cares what the pollsters say? What do the bookies say? Well, I haven't checked the Vegas odds yet, but we'll give it a shot.
And what makes you think that the bookies aren't looking at the polls?
There you go. You know, where the money is, right? So we go to Catherine, who says, I suggest that we use the term an erotum of polls. All right. Dave says, Alan, please explain the difference between internal and regular polling. Is it considered to be more accurate?
I think they think it is. Look, everyone, they wouldn't be doing these polls unless they wanted to know who was going to turn out, because it's, as Bob says, it's all about turnout. And so they all do it, and they spend a great deal of money, doing it. I think that they have faith in their own polls. And in some cases, they want to do them so that they can turn around. And even if they're losing, say, look, our polls are showing we're winning. And they say that all the time. But I think there's a rule. Bob or Chris, maybe one of you guys knows. Isn't there a rule that if you can't release the poll without you can't characterize it without releasing the actual numbers? Am I wrong about that?
I'm really not sure, to be honest with you, Alan.
In other words, you can't refer to a poll. You can't say we're leading in our poll. And I think there are rules about having to say what's in the poll. You have to come clean on the whole thing, which is why a lot of politicians don't like to do that. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, we've certainly seen cases in the past where politicians were fooled by internal polls. I think Mitt Romney was stunned that he lost Ohio because his internal polling showed that he was well up there. I mean, the internal polls can be as bad as the public polls. It's just, you know, the pollsters are making a guessing game. They're trying to gauge who will come out to vote, and it's very, very difficult to do that. And it's become increasingly difficult to do that. Because it's so difficult to get people on the phone now. I mean,
so I have a question for you, Chris.
When people just picked up their landline and were willing to answer questions for 45 minutes, and I've actually worked as a pollster. I know how hard it can be to get people to agree to very long polls. But go ahead, Alan.
I have a question for you because I consider you to be a brilliant columnist and a brilliant man. So who is going to win this election in Georgia?
Why don't we just wait and find out on January?
Just wait till the 5th. Yeah.
Don't you see what I did there?
It is this weird phenomenon, and you know the media is certainly guilty of this, of always having to know or having to predict. Why don't we just wait? It's not that long from now, and it's up in the air. If I had to guess, if I had to make a prediction, if you forced me to, I think it will actually be a split. I think Purdue will win, and I think Warnock will win. But yeah. I am not basing that on anything more than a hunch.
And you also have to wonder about in looking at those numbers where they are right now of we talked about turnout, but God only knows what's going to happen between now and then. I mean, as you said, yes, it's not that far away, but it's also a long way away.
And you better remember that everything that Mitch McConnell is doing right now is tied to that race, because that race is his power. In other words, if he loses both of those seats, goodbye, Mitch. Who is he? Mitch who?
Mitch McConnell cares deeply about those races, but you know who doesn't care deeply about those races? It's President Trump.
That's right.
I mean, I don't think he cares one way or the other. There's even report out that he's fundraising off those races, claiming that he's going to put the money toward the Senate candidates, and then putting the money in that PAC that's been getting rich off the election fraud claims. I mean, President Trump is looking out for Trump, and I think he's a real wild card in this race. We just don't know what he's going to tweet at the last minute or say or do. It's one of the reasons that I think pollsters just can't possibly predict this race.
We have letters I want to get to. We'll do that and welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this short break. One Charta, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo make up the panel this morning. We go to your letters. Sheila writes to us and says it's a bit surprising that the media has not discussed Mitch's wife, Elaine Chao, being appointed by Trump to a board, I forget which, I believe it was the Kennedy Center board, post his presidency. If this is not corruption, I don't know what is, and may explain why the majority leader held out so long as he did.
She needs the money, or she does.
Well, she's also Secretary of Transportation. I mean, she sits on.
She won't be.
Yeah, I mean, no, this is post. This is post Trump.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Right.
Yeah, this is post Trump. Okay, let's see. We go to Kara, who says the vice president is the president of the Senate. Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, for those of you keeping score at home. How come McConnell yields power he really doesn't have?
Well, because he has the votes. He's the majority leader. The majority leader is the head guy. The vice president is, unless what could happen here, if both Democrats win, then the vice president is going to be the tiebreaker in all of these crucial votes, which is going to deliver it to the Democrats. But no, the vice president, under normal circumstances, forget about that as a powerful position in the Senate.
Vesta writes to us and says the Republicans have sold their souls to Trump a long time ago, either cheering him on or staying silent. They have listened to his racist rants, watch him cozy up to Putin, separate children from their parents, mangle the COVID crisis, and attack civil servants to the point they need security. Senators like Flake and Corker left rather than deal with Trump. Like a toddler, Trump ups the ante with every outrage, and they let him go too long. McConnell had to step in so Republicans didn't have to vote against Trump. We then turn to Laura's letter, where she says, listening to your conversation this morning, it occurred to me that politicians are ignoring climate change, to their peril, I believe. As unprecedented wildfires, hurricanes, and floods slam through the West, Texas, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, people are leaving their states. The state's voter demographics are changing. States are becoming more diverse. Politicians need to educate themselves about all of this and address their messaging accordingly.
You mean to say you think that the politicians don't know that the world is going to collapse and that they vote against the interests of themselves, their wives, their children, their grandchildren? I have a feeling they know it, and they just haven't got the guts to say it, especially on the Republican side.
Kevin says, could Trump use the war chest from Georgia to pay for real estate or other things like that?
Yeah, people have asked me that a lot. I'm not actually sure what he can and can't use the. I mean, I think it has to be related to a political purpose, but that's kind of a vague. I don't know exactly what he.
Rosemary, you seemed a little more definitive in your answer.
I think that Chris is actually right. The rules are extremely lax, and basically you have lots of leeway into what you're spending money on. So you have to relate it to politics. But Trump is kind of an expert with lots of experience in relating everything in his personal business to politics. So I don't think he would have any trouble converting money that he's stealing from the Georgia elections to his own needs and wants.
We're talking about a family that actually is not allowed to run nonprofits because they misuse the money. Why would anybody think that this is going to be any different? I mean, seriously. I mean, the leopard doesn't change its spots.
Are not bright.
You're saying there's a track record here.
Wait. What did you say, Rosemary? That's good. What did you say?
They would believe that because the American people have proven themselves to be not very astute in their political decision making. And we know that from the past 4 years and the continued 74 million people voting for Trump in 2020.
Let's go to Jeff's letter. If the Democrats win both seats in Georgia, will there be no Senate majority leader since neither party will hold a majority? Will there be co-minority leaders? How will that work?
Majority leaders. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was about to say Schumer assumes the McConnell position, and I think he becomes the pro temp position in the Senate. But Schumer, I mean, basically, it would be a complete shift. And Joe, complete shift, I'd say everything. They actually move offices, and I mean, there's a whole set of perks that go
new
along
drapes,
with
new drapes, new.
Oh no, you laugh, but that's you know, when you hear people say, you know, they were too busy measuring the drapes rather than run elections. That's what they're talking about.
David, I believe this has happened once before. In other words, that Harry Reid and whoever the other guy was literally had to share power. So, the vice president is going to have a great deal to say on an awful lot here.
David writes and says, isn't it likely that the races in Georgia will be so close the results won't be certified for a few weeks or months? That's what happened to Al Franken. In that case, Mitch McConnell would remain majority leader for a while. Could you comment on that possibility? That Franken race took months, right? I think it was June before he was finally seated. Norm Coleman, right?
I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, Georgia just had a trial run, right? I mean, not a trial run. It wasn't a trial. It was the real deal, you know. And they managed to do a paper recount and do all the things that would be done quicker than that. So I'm not sure that it would take that long.
I agree with Chris. I don't think it's going to take that long. They actually had a pretty buttoned down election. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Governor Kemp, but the Secretary of State there, but they did a good job, you know.
But you also if the Republicans were to lose, or at least one of the Republicans was to lose, would they accept the results of the election? Especially if it's really close. I mean, that's the other thing too. Do they pull a Trump?
Or a Stacey Abrams?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. yeah. Good point, Chris. Good point. Marty says, what do you think? Go ahead.
I think we can't discount the fact that if what President Trump says is true, Brian Kemp and the Secretary of State will be in jail by then. So it'll be, you know, who knows what will happen.
Marty says, what do you think of Barr's action to bring back firing squads and lethal gas as acceptable methods of execution for federal crimes before he left the administration? No one really knows why he left, but some speculate that perhaps he may have disagreed with the direction the administration is going.
Well, there's a lot to unpack.
Barr showed no indication that he was faint of heart about killing people who are enemies of Trump. I think it's immoral and horrible he did it, and I hope that the effort will end when Joe Biden comes into office. We should not be killing people.
Bob?
Yeah, I'm not prepared to claim that Barr can redeem his reputation. I think he has been so immoral and unethical in the position that in my mind he will always be stained. So this idea that he left early because, you know, all of a sudden he got some sort of religion is I think it's garbage. I think that you can only put up working for the man baby for so long, and I'm sure the personal attacks were enough, and he said, "Nah, screw it, it's not worth it." But it's nothing noble. I mean, there's nothing noble that Bill Barr has done.
Yep.
I want to go back to something Rosemary said before our bottom of the hour break, and that was talking about McConnell and where we are. We were talking about motive, I believe, at that time, and McConnell finally coming out and saying that Joe Biden is the president-elect. But we were talking, you made the point, Rosemary, about the stimulus and of where we are in that and why that takes so, why that has been such, like, what's the end game there? And we're hearing the same words that we heard right up to the very beginning,
right?
Like the hours before the election, when Mnuchin was still saying, you know, we're just hours away from passing a deal and we never got it.
Right, right. So it's hard to believe in it. And I think that there's been a vast power play at work here. It would seem that if anything, there should be bipartisan agreement that a huge stimulus relief package is needed for the economy, for decency, for people who are going to be out of work and really struggling. There's going to be a cataclysm if this economy is allowed to go past Christmas without relief for people who will lose unemployment, who will lose protection against evictions. It's just horrendous. And yet Mitch McConnell has brought us to this point because I think he wants to make a point with Nancy Pelosi and because he's so intent on protecting companies. He wants that protection from liability. You wouldn't be able to sue a company that cost you your job because you were listening to what the government said. So he would be protecting Republican governors and companies. That's what he's doing. And I think he's been, as he is in most things, extremely successful in this. If we do get an agreement right now, I think it's going to be far beneath what Schumer and Pelosi had originally wanted. And that will have been every dollar lost from that agreement will be a triumph for Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, and when do
Joe, you're talking about somebody who has knowingly and purposefully undermined the basis of our government and democracy.
Yeah.
So why would we think that he wouldn't undermine the our overall economy in order to continue to prove these points? A couple of things I will toss about the stimulus, though. You know, there. If you start to think about money, particularly to state and local government, you think it would be a no-brainer until you start to look at it and realize that this is a continuation of the blue versus red. And so when you look at the largest states, which are more much more blue, with an expectation of a very different degree of services and responsibility to our citizens than a place like Kentucky has. There's a lot of partisanship there. I also, this is the initial salvo in the Senate's efforts to control the Biden administration through money. The same crap that we saw with Obama and this fake fiscal conservatism. Yep. That they absolutely blew out the window with Trump is going to make a comeback because all of a sudden they're going to be fiscally conservative again. It's a game, and it also shows the decay and rot in D.C.
Decay and rot. Let's see. We have a minute. Let me get to two letters. Joel writes, Tom Daschle and Trent Lott had a power sharing agreement in 2001.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Thank you, panel, or thank you, listener. Joni writes, how can we be sure McConnell will give up his position setting the agenda in the Senate under a tie vote? Are you saying that Kamala Harris would be casting the tie breaking vote deciding that?
Yes.
Say that again, Joe.
She would.
They pass the rules of the Senate, and she'll have the deciding vote. So the rules of the Senate will determine how, you know, Ways and Means puts bills forward. So it will be shared because of the numbers to a certain extent, but it's still the Democrats would have the upper hand in that.
To Alan's point here, I think I understand, but I'm not positive I understand what she's writing. She says, how can we be sure McConnell will give up his position setting the agenda in the Senate under a tie vote? And I guess that means total in the Senate, not if there is not a clear-cut winner initially, which we were also talking about, right?
That's why that letter was so important that we just read. It was something I knew. I didn't know the names, but I knew we had had it once before. There'll have to be some kind of an agreement as to how to move forward. It's not a matter of agreeing to give it up, but agreeing how to make it work. That won't be easy. Yeah.
But
there's a couple of points here, though. Remember that the Senate under Daschle and Lott was much more genteel. There was this notion that you had to work together for the betterment of the country. They had rules in place to try to protect the institution of the Senate, which have all been blown out of the water. I mean, so if you think about what happened with Merrick Garland, if you start to think about what they just did with the Supreme Court appointment of Barrett, I mean, it is just raw power that was not used in the same way under past Senate leadership. The question is, you know, for me, is whether Schumer and the Democrats will play as rough and tumble hardball as the Republicans did, and if they have the majority, look at them and say, "Yeah, tough, you lost the election."
What do you think the answer is?
We're frightfully late, but go ahead, quick answer, and then we have to go.
I think we run a real risk with Biden's efforts to try to unify. He's going to try to reach too far over the aisle, and there has to be a point when it's just you lost the election, and there are results for losing the election.
All right,
I do worry about it.
We're going to pause there. When we come back, we'll continue. Ray Graff has news, and then we'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the panel and our conversation this morning on WAMC. We welcome Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo, who make up the group. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Let us go to just a couple of letters, and then we're going to move over to the discussion about Joe Biden and his picks for cabinet picks. Michael says, I agree with Rosemary about Mitch protecting companies from liability, but I'm disappointed with the media not making more of this. Who are the meatpacking plants in Kentucky who've been giving him money to protect them? People are dying, and they are knowingly putting workers in harm's way to make a profit. In this election season, seems to me voters, especially in Georgia now, would be bothered by the GOP's insistence on this at the expense of those losing their homes and getting COVID. Anyone?
Well, yeah. Okay. So it really is a matter of class, not specific businesses. So the letter writer asks us, which of these guys is giving money to the Senate Democrats, for example? Well, yeah, that's true. That happens all the time. That's what lobbying is all about. Nevertheless, you can think that when it all comes down to this, Mitch McConnell is a Republican. He believes in Republican principles, which are to help businesses. That's simple. So it really isn't who's paying him off. It's that is the Republican way.
Bob?
Yeah, no, Alan's spot on is that, you know, this reflects a common theme through most Republican policy platforms. Of course, we didn't have one with this current presidential election, but typically it's pro-business, protecting business from overregulation, so it is not particularly surprising. What I still think is surprising to me is the fact that a lot of what I would consider to be blue collar folks have adopted Trump as somehow their representative when he's never done a day's worth of blue collar work in his life and has a history of bankrupting and not paying bills to people who actually do work. But he's been elevated to this protectorate of the working people, which is really strange to me.
But don't you think that has to do with race?
Yeah, I do. I think race definitely plays a role in it. But I also think there's socioeconomic
and race is socioeconomic, and standards.
But I'm saying that race is definitely a part of it, Alan.
Chris, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I would just say that the Democrats haven't been great for working people in a few decades. Also, I mean, part of the reason there was a migration to Trump and a lot of the industrial Midwest is things like NAFTA and other policies that the Democrats signed on to that chipped away jobs. I take the point about Republicans being business friendly, but I think Democrats are often just as friendly to businesses and Wall Street and hedge funds as Republicans often are.
Rosemary?
I don't think I have anything to add. I agree. It's not working man friendly to help out big corporations. They're the big lobbyists. That's where the money is. This has nothing to do with people, working class people on either party right now. It will be very interesting to see if Joe Biden, who has made his whole career saying I'm from Scranton, I'm a working class man, if he can make a difference in that. I think it would take changes that are beyond his ability and his control of the Congress to make happen.
Yeah, but Rosemary, I would disagree with that. I mean, it is true that he presents himself as a working class man, but if you look at the things he's actually lobbied for, he has lobbied for getting rid of bankruptcy protections for working class people, and he's lobbied on behalf of all the credit card companies in Delaware. I mean, I think Joe Biden's record kind of illustrates what I was talking about how Democrats have not exactly been loyal to what used to be their working class base.
Part of the problem is that it's so hard to interpret when helping business is helping the working class. And I think Biden is susceptible to Republican talking points, which you just repeated about the credit cards and all that. AOC is coming into that now. She is herself a working class woman. And yet she's being portrayed now as hurting working class people because she didn't want Amazon coming into a neighborhood, which would have meant tons of jobs. Was she helping people? She at the time was talking about bad working conditions that Amazon presents, or was she hurting them? And I think that Democrats have fallen into that. And partly it's because, as I keep repeating, they're so bad at messaging. They do not ever keep putting out there the way Republicans do how we have helped.
Well, it's also about donors. I mean, Joe Biden was on the side of the credit card companies because they're all headquartered in his home state, and he needed their money to win re-election every year. I mean, AOC, who, you know, has her faults for sure, but she isn't as beholden to donors because she doesn't need them to win the way that other Democrats do. I mean, this is all part of the massive drive to raise money. I mean, that's why Democrats moved onto the side of Wall Street, you know, I guess during the Clinton
which,
era.
Which brings us back to Citizens United and the Supreme Court. Right. This is, things were utterly and forever screwed up in 2010 with Citizens United. There is no other way to get money enough to win national elections except from big companies. The closest, I guess, we came was Bernie. And that was unprecedented and unique. I think we end up back at the Supreme Court, and we do not have a court right now that is going to reverse Citizens United.
I don't disagree with anything you said, but I'll just point out that this trend was underway long before Citizens United. I mean, this Democrats started courting Wall Street heavily in the 90s, you know, 20 years before Citizens United was decided.
Yeah, when unions under Reagan, we lost unions,
yes.
And that had been a source of huge money for Democrats. That's true.
Yeah, you're right on. I was just going to say, actually, I would have pegged it back towards Reagan, in Reaganomics, and that's when you really started to see the bottom getting knocked out of organized labor, and the change, the flipping of a lot of state houses to the GOP, which then resulted in the redistricting and gerrymandering, which then resulted in taking over Congress with the Gingrich gang that came in. I mean, so this is long.
Democrats made the mistake while all this was happening of not paying attention to the local and state level, but to concentrate on the presidency. And that is a mistake that is now recognized and has to be worked on. The Democrats need to be working in the state houses, not in New York so much, but definitely in the Midwest.
Yeah. And what did Tip O'Neill say? All politics are local.
Yeah.
And that is so true.
Yeah. Alan, anything else on that?
No, but I'm enjoying the conversation.
Well, I'm glad. Whatever we can do to help. If you have any requests, please let us know.
I do have a request. Somebody just left us some big, beautiful gingerbread cookies on the porch. And I said to Roselle, what if they're poison?
Oh, my gosh.
Was there a note that said who they're from?
And Roselle made a face at me and gave me one, and I ate it. So I may be dying before your very eyes.
It's a good way to die.
You could put food tester on your resume now, Alan.
I went to the post office. We were saying nice things about the post office yesterday, as we should be saying about the post office, because they're wonderful. And I was at the post office yesterday. I was standing in a rather long line, and I was waiting. And there was a woman in front of me, and she had this huge box. And what I would call a fruit box, in the sense that it had handles on the side of it, a large cardboard box, and it had an open top. So I couldn't see what was in it. It was just a lot of stuff. But I will admit, I rolled my eyes a little, going, oh, this is the person I get behind. This is going to take me forever. So the woman gets up to the counter, and she starts taking out all of these Tupperware containers of cookies that she had made for all the postal workers. And it was like the sweetest thing. They were all crying. And then I felt very bad.
And now that leads to another.
No, I don't think they were poisoned. I think they knew. And of course, Rosemary, they know where she lives.
That leads to another question, which is, you're not supposed to give, I think the rule is you can give postal workers, I hope I'm not wrong about this, you can give postal workers gifts up to $20. In other words, you can give them a gift that is worth $20, no more. And it's like when the advisors tell you how to leave your children money, you can give money to one and the other also, you know. So can the husband and wife each give the postal guy $20?
Well, I don't know, but I have to say, I don't know about the legalities of that, but just judging by the reaction of the postal workers that I saw, they would much rather have the cookies than $20.
You know, and Joe,
I've got to get money out in the card for my paper boy, my newspaper boy. I'm thinking of just putting in an envelope and flinging it out on the front yard, and he has to go find it
in the rain.
Yeah, wait for the snow tomorrow, Rosemary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob, you were gonna say?
Yeah, I was just gonna note that, you know, we do underestimate the power of just small acts of random kindness. And you know, I'm going to take a little bit more serious note on this, is that given everything that's gone on with this horrible, horrible year, you know, that I love stories like that. And I just ask everybody who's listening to, you know, take a couple of moments and see, you know, you don't have to bake cookies, but, you know, small ways of thanking the folks around you in unexpected ways can help get us through this stinking pandemic and this rotten administration.
Yeah, it's they're very nice people out there, and I don't know how these people voted. I don't know what they, but I do know they did a very, very nice thing yesterday, and it was very sweet. And
especially the people who left us the gingerbread cookies in case you get the wrong message.
That's right. I'm gonna hold my thoughts on that until 10:50 to make sure if you live that long. But yes, absolutely. let's see. We'll go to talking about, we have one more letter and then I'll go to the Biden cabinet picks. Marty says, I was a Senate intern when the Democrats first obtained the majority in New York in 2009. They spent the first few months of their term physically moving into the former GOP majority offices. The next few months saw little accomplished save for a few indictments against their members, including the majority leader. Their majority was quickly extinguished. I hope the National Democrats put on a better showing if they win Georgia.
As petty as it sounds, to the victor goes the spoils, and it's bigger offices and better locations. It's also one of the perks that the speaker enjoys. If you anger the speaker, you end up in one of the basement offices with no windows, which some members of Congress take as a point of pride, and others are so horrified that they do whatever they can to get back in good graces.
Yeah, you remember when that guy, I think it was Bragman, Michael Bragman, ran against Shelley, I believe, and lost terribly, and he was consigned to the basement, as I remember it.
No drapes in the basement.
Yeah, and the famous statement of you can tell me where to sit, but you can't tell me where to stand was I always remember that that comment according to that.
When I worked as an intern, they moved us from the Cannon Building, which was, you know, they delivered ice to the door every day. And then what they did was to give us the Rayburn Building, which was like going to the greatest place in the world. There was a huge difference in the quality of those offices.
I want to go to... Go ahead. No, nothing? All right. Ruth says, I agree with Rosemary. Democrats are terrible at messaging. They also adapt to Republicans' messages that are harmful. Obamacare, said with a sneer, is one example. Also, defending the police has been a deadly phrase.
Yeah, the defunding police, I agree with you. Death panels during healthcare was awful. Obamacare, I kind of disagree with you. Obama himself said, yeah, I'm proud of it. I take that. And so it's like, it's become, I don't think it's pejorative now to talk about Obamacare. But that aside, everything else, they just do really go along. They accept the narrative that's presented by the Republicans, and it's ruinous. The Green New Deal has now become code for socialism. How'd that happen? That's not what it's about at all, because Democrats led it.
Now we get the letters from the tax preparers. It isn't just postal workers, teachers too. It's a taxation issue. Over $25 gift limit should be declared as income, according to this letter. for what
and,
it is.
But there are also ethics laws about what you can and cannot accept.
Are cookies okay?
Federal government.
Cookies are okay.
Yeah, because they're considered to be below below the threshold. But there's a whole set of ethics laws that, as a federal employee, you have to sign off on and do training, as you do with the state. The state has pretty strict ethics laws for folks that work.
We got this from Gene, who says, the panel keeps up bringing the Amazon deal as a way to put down AOC. I think we're putting down. I think Rosemary was using it as an example, but okay. Please note that Amazon actually came to New York City anyway, and without billions of dollars in subsidies, AOC was right, so give her credit
right.
for it.
I agree with that, but she has been attacked. She's been attacked as someone who is against the working class people who need jobs in her district because of her her efforts against Amazon. And I agree with the writer that these are misdirected. But it proves my point about how the Republicans are incredibly effective with messaging. I'll point out Joe Biden as a socialist, give me a break. He's the definition of a capitalist, as Chris himself pointed out earlier today. And yet many Latino voters voted against him because they thought he was going to be a Fidel-like socialist. It's just messaging.
Quick programming note that – go ahead. No, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say that Amazon deal was exactly what I was talking about how Democrats have gotten too cozy with big business. I mean, they were AOC. I was with AOC on that. Cuomo, right. the governor, wanted to give away, I think it was $500 million, one of the wealthiest corporations
Correct.
In the world. And those weren't going to be right. working class jobs. Those were office jobs. Those were,
yeah,
yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Rosemary. As long as you agree that I'm right, I'll stop talking.
I know. I've learned how to make you be quiet.
We have a quick programming note, and that is that the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, will be giving an update at 11:30 this morning. We'll be talking about, I assume, not only the pandemic and the state's response to it, but also given the number of press releases that have been coming from the governor's office this morning. I think they'll be talking about the storm as well. But that will be live as soon as it occurs, which is expected to be right around 11:30 this morning. So we will plan on that. We just have about 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Joe, before you go on, something
yeah, sure.
just made sense to me. You know, Chris's love for
congratulations.
Snow. You think about it. He wrote that whole thing about Frozen. I mean, there's a theme through Chris Churchill's work that really linked
you're
to
right.
winter. You know?
Well, I'm glad you're reading so closely. Yes, I do enjoy winter, and I find the panel's anti-white Christmas take to be rather Grinch-like, I have to be honest.
I proudly wear that badge.
we wanted to, right, Rosemary? We wanted to applaud Chris. Oh, for the Elise Stefanik column, that's right.
Oh, the Elise Stefanik.
Excellent.
Yes. I forgive you a lot for that, Chris. That was really right on.
If for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, Chris wrote a column that appeared in yesterday's Times Union, which you can find online, and the title is "Maybe Elise Stefanik's Win Was Fraudulent Too." According to a Texas lawsuit that sought to overturn the 2020 presidential election, New York's elections might be unconstitutional as well. Chris, we were applauding you and saying how great it was, so I'll give you the opportunity to explain it a little bit.
Well, it was basically taking Elise Stefanik, the North Country congresswoman, to task a little bit for signing on to that ludicrous Texas lawsuit, which sought to throw out the election results in four states. I mean, everything that lawsuit claimed could also apply to New York, because it was saying it's unconstitutional to change your voting rules ahead of an election and to have it done by an executive. Well, the same exact thing happened in New York. So if those results are questionable, then Elise Stefanik's win is also questionable. And, her counties and her areas also use the Dominion voting machines that are at the heart of all these conspiracy theories. So how do we know that she didn't have votes switched in her direction? I mean, I'm not saying that she did, but my point was that if you question one legit election or undermine one legitimate election, the problem with that is that all legitimate elections can be undermined. You know, and I think I think her signing on to that, and you know, and the others who did it, just incredibly dangerous and incredibly cynical, really, because I don't think any of them actually believe in that lawsuit. I think they just did it to curry favor.
Kudos to you. We're going to take a break. We'll say more nice things about Chris when we come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. About 15 minutes left with the panel this morning, and I promised you a story about Joe Biden's cabinet picks, and by gum, we're going to get to it. So yesterday, the news was that Joe Biden had tapped Pete Buttigieg for transportation secretary, his former rival. And he also announced that he intends to choose former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm as his energy secretary and plans to tap Gina McCarthy, a former Environmental Protection Agency chief, for the powerful new position of domestic climate chief to run his climate plans across the federal government. All three will be central to Biden's plan to remake the country's automobiles and transportation systems to quickly cut climate-damaging petroleum emissions. Buttigieg would be the first openly gay person confirmed by the Senate to a cabinet post at 38. The former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, would also add a youthful dynamic to an incoming administration that is so far dominated by a large part by leaders with decades of Washington experience. Granholm served as Michigan's Attorney General from 1999 to 2003 and two terms as Michigan's first female governor from 2003 to 2010. She was a supporter of Biden's presidential bid and has spoken out forcefully against President Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the election, accusing him of, quote, poisoning democracy. So there you go of three picks. What do you think, Alan?
I think they're all good picks. I think you're exactly right. The Buttigieg, and I said so earlier this morning, you know, he's trying to balance the cabinet, and this is a youthful appearance. I also think Buttigieg is very, very smart. Smart counts for a lot. Competency counts for a lot. I think the tip of the hat to Michigan and the former governor is a brilliant move, because Michigan could go either way. You have to be thinking about the future also. And she's obviously a very bright and remarkable woman. So I think these are all, and the emphasis on the environment is so well needed. I mean, we don't have Judith with us today, but we all know that this world is going to hell. And that there's not much that's being done about it. In fact, quite the reverse with a guy like Trump, who is basically a climate denier. End of sentence.
Rosemary.
Well, I want to say yay. For the first time, we could end up with a cabinet that has more women than men, and not one of them is there only because she's a woman. So Biden has, if he gets them all confirmed, has done something long overdue and something of a recompense both for the Trump administration, which had a dearth of women, and for his own past behavior with Anita Hill. I see this as penance and just a great thing to celebrate. These are wonderful picks. I think that with both the new transportation secretary and the new energy secretary, Biden is getting people who can do double duty, because both of them are amazing communicators, effective on television, effective. Buttigieg is effective with the Fox crowd, in addition to both knowing tons about energy and the auto industry and infrastructure. I think they would be remarkable as a team, not just simply individually. And finally, I would like to see a description for the job, a job description for energy secretary, because look at the weirdos, the weird selections we have had in that job. We went from a Nobel Prize winner under Obama to Rick Perry, who was an idiot under Trump's one of his first picks. Now to a woman who doesn't have any particular, she does have, the auto industry, but this is a job that also is involved with the nuclear codes, and this woman knows nothing about that. So I think it's a very, very extremely odd job.
Bob.
And Rosemary, you hit on something I think that most folks don't realize, that the vast majority of the Department of Energy's budget is dealing with the nuclear stockpile. And that's when Rick Perry was talking about getting rid of the Department of Energy, everybody was sort of in D.C. was sort of looking cockeyed at him, going, "You just don't understand what they really do." In fact, all of the work on with the auto industry and on reusable, renewable energies is a small part of that of their budget. Overall, you know, I look at the competence that he's bringing into his cabinet, and I think that's really important. So you hit on something, Rosemary. You get the added bonus of the diversity and inclusiveness of his cabinet, which means that he's going to be hearing from folks that are going to give him a much broader view. And I say him, Biden, much broader view of what's going on in the country. But they are all subject matter experts. And it's that type of competence that I hope will start to restore confidence in government.
Chris Churchill.
So this is going to sound like a knock on Pete Buttigieg, but I really don't mean it that way. But it just goes to highlight how improbable his presidential candidacy was. As I was reading some of the stories about the various cabinet picks, I mean, one of the things that really leaps out is just how thin Pete's resume is. And I know that he brings other things to this. To the role, but when you look at Jennifer Granholm, who was a two-term governor and has all these other experiences under her belt, and then you look at Pete Buttigieg, who was only a mayor of a very, very small Midwestern city, it is remarkable how far he's come.
But
again, I don't really mean that as a knock on what he has accomplished, because he does, as somebody mentioned, he does bring communication skills, and it is helpful to have somebody in the cabinet who is under the age of 40, or I think he's under 40, isn't he?
Yes, 38 years old.
Yeah.
It's
good to have some youthful perspective there, but it's remarkable how far he's traveled.
Well, you know what I was talking about? What I was talking about him? I just said how bright he is. Now, when we all heard him for the first time when he was running for president, and you're right, that was improbable, Chris. But it was extraordinary how bright the guy is and how so many of us connected with him.
Well, and he struck a chord. I mean, he did very well in the primaries. I mean, he certainly held his own for a while anyway, early on. He had a constituency. But also, man, did he play his cards right with Joe Biden. I mean, he was out. He got out.
Oh, that's right.
He got out at a really good time. That was very helpful. It was a full-throated support, and from the press reports that I read yesterday, he worked really hard on the campaign and became a very trusted advisor to the now president-elect.
And could I toss a different thought at you, Chris? And I don't disagree. I mean, his about his resume, but at the same time, I really like the idea that there's somebody with local government experience on the cabinet.
It's
state government or it's federal government. But the idea that somebody who actually has got to deal with the potholes has to deal with the infrastructure. And if the infrastructure bill is going to come to fruition, which I personally feel is absolutely critical to our long term future, both economically and as far as the society, he's going to bring a very different perspective than a lot of the other cabinet members. And again, I think that also helps round out the voices that Biden is going to hear from.
I'm like the biggest fan of experience ever on this panel, and I bemoan the loss of Hillary Clinton and people like Hubert Humphrey who had baggage but knew how government worked. I think that Johnson was one of the best presidents we had because he could get anything, literally anything, through Congress, and we don't have that now. However, politics has always made room for, and we are the better for it, for people who have not the experience but uncommon charisma and connection. And Obama was one of them. AOC, I think, is one of them, and so is Pete Buttigieg.
Chris,
take it a step further. Think about what experience did John F. Kennedy bring? I mean, it was pretty thin.
Yeah. Oh, that. Yeah. Okay. Let's anybody else on that subject? Okay. We move to probably the final one here, which is news from the FDA that they are authorizing the first rapid over-the-counter home coronavirus test. These could be at your local pharmacy by January. The Food and Drug Administration on Tuesday authorized the first rapid coronavirus test that can be taken at home without prescription and that yields immediate results. The test could be a vital tool in the country's fight against the virus, especially in the months before most Americans will be able to be vaccinated. Unlike previous home tests, this version does not require samples to be sent to a lab and can be taken without a doctor's orders by anyone older than 2 years old. The test that was developed by an Australian company is just one of several positive developments for coronavirus testing. After months of failures, long lines, and continued shortages, the country's testing capacity is finally expected to increase rapidly in the coming 2 to 3 months, reaching many times its current levels, experts said. That reflects new technologies coming online and longstanding investments to ramp up production that are coming to fruition. The only question I had on this, which I was looking for an answer for, and I didn't find a really good one, which is how does it then go into, because my understanding is that it requires you to put it into an app, right? So I guess that will help with the tracking. So we'll still be able to get the numbers that we're getting right now.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You have it exactly right. You put it in the app and it goes into the statistics.
Chris, you know, or Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, Joe, it's a, this obviously is a good news story. But I'm going to throw this out to the panel and to listeners to think about. One of the things that frustrates me about this story and about our approach to COVID is, imagine if as a people, we had taken the AIDS epidemic, if we had taken on cancer, if we taken on heart disease with the same vigor and support, monetary support and policy support, what we could do as a people. And again, I'm celebrating that the test is out there. I do question, though, as a people, of why have we permitted ourselves to not be as safe and healthy a community as we possibly could be. And if we harness the power of the federal government and the private industry, we can solve almost any problem. So what it tells me is that we decided that we don't want to solve some of these problems, which is a real public policy concern.
Hmm. Yes, and on this particular thing, this particular thing that has been raised by Joe, there's still the question about whether everybody wants to know whether they have the virus. You know what I'm saying here? In other words,
yeah, I mean, I can't figure that in my brain because right when I read the story, I was like, oh, I wonder how I get 20 of them.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. People are going to make a lot of money because I would have bought it 50 times by now at 30 bucks a pop.
The minute I have a scratchy throat, I'm spitting into that tube.
There's a second one that's 50 bucks a pop.
Yeah, well, right, but so, yeah, exactly. But it's a good point. Bob, I think it's interesting. I mean, but does it show... I mean, we certainly have made attempts to conquer some of the illnesses that you have mentioned, most notably cancer, but what is the holdup then?
I would push back respectfully saying that I don't think we have targeted the ingenuity and might and capacity of our society the way we have with COVID. Respectfully, I would argue that we could have and should be doing a lot more. And you think about our long-term health and the economy, all of these other issues are as important to me as COVID is. And I would really hold up the point of how we mishandled AIDS and HIV.
Yeah.
And it became a partisan political issue
did COVID.
Frankly played with people's lives. Yeah.
We have two letters here.
Joe Biden once called for a national crusade against cancer.
Right.
So perhaps it could happen. We will get back to that. We have just come from 4 years of an administration that made defense spending, including on such weirdness as a Space Force, higher priorities than the health of the people. And there is a difference, I will note, between a pandemic caused by a virus and cancer or ALS or the other diseases that plague Americans and the world. And that's that lifestyle has nothing to do with it whatsoever. There's a wide variance in how you're affected, and you have no control over whether you get it or not. So there's kind of a built-in political push to do something about the virus that's different from AIDS or cancer or heart disease. Mm-hmm.
In the minute we have left, I'll get to two letters that we have regarding Pete Buttigieg. One, Jason says, he ran a city. What was Joe Biden's extensive experience when he was elected to the Senate at 29? Give me a break, says Jason. Michelle writes, Buttigieg was an analyst at McKinsey in the Department of Transportation and will have a lot to say as in regards to managing the infrastructure building. So those are letters from our listeners. We thank you very much for being a part of our discussion today and apologize for the letters that we didn't get to. Alan, thank you very much. Chris,
you're welcome. I'm still alive.
Good, good. Are you going to have another lettuce? Only one cookie? Is Roselle, like, did you let... Is Roselle just watching you?
Roselle knows it's our wonderful neighbor.
Oh, okay. All right. Good. Yeah. All right. I was wondering, like, if Roselle let you eat the cookie and was watching.
She baked them.
Rosemary, Bob, and Chris, thank you very much. We'll be back with a Congressional Corner right after this.
Thanks.
0.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK HD 90.9 Kingston, WOSR HD 91.7 Middletown, WCEL HD 91.9 Plattsburgh, WCAN HD 93.3 Canajoharie, WANC HD 103.9 Ticonderoga, WAMQ HD 105.1 Great Barrington, WWES HD 88.9 Mount Kisco, WANZ HD 90.1 Stamford, WANR 88.5 Brewster, and WAMC AM 1400 Albany.